Good evening. This is Frank McGee, back with a special half hour that is, we think, likely to stir the memories of hundreds of thousands of Monitor listeners. Do you recognize this voice?
Good evening. I think it's worth reporting at length on the reaction of the United States to Mr. Chamberlain's promise of help to Poland. The Chamberlain pronouncements are understood as bringing a momentous and historic change in British policy. It is my impression that they are approved with more fervor and indeed gratitude than anything that Mr. Chamberlain has done. On the whole, Americans did not like Munich or even the doctrine of appeasement. Many of them thought that a stand had to be made against the dictators, and many of them wanted it made last year or earlier. Now it is made and they welcome it.
That was Raymond Graham Swing, who throughout the 30s and the 40s was one of the country's, indeed one of the world's foremost radio commentators. And what you heard him say in that excerpt of a broadcast of 25 years ago over NBC was typical of what he always had to say. 15 minutes a night, 4 nights a week. And when he spoke, 37 million people listened, including presidents and prime ministers and dictators. Well, Raymond Swing, he's dropped the middle name Graham, will be 77 this week. His book of personal memoirs, appropriately called Good Evening, will be out, and many of his friends are gathering in New York to honor him. Men such as Walter Lippmann and John Gunther and scores of others. Among other things, they'll present him with a golden reel of tape recordings, past and present, including what you're about to hear this evening. Welcome to Monitor, Mr. Swing. We're very proud to have you. Tell me, how long has it been since you've been before these NBC microphones?
I think the last time was in 47.
How does it feel to be back?
Well, it feels... I won't say like Lazarus, but pretty near like it.
If I were to say to you, Mr. Swing, the microphone is yours for 2 minutes, what more than anything else would you like to say?
I would like to talk about the necessity of establishing world peace in a world of law without national armies and the danger of national wars. Mm-hmm. This is the basic question that underlies all the problems of the world today. We live now in a world of power, much, much too much power. And this power has the capacity to destroy civilization and possibly life on this planet. It's a very difficult thing to dismantle power because it takes infinite patience and infinite skepticism. And you have to go very slowly about it. And this is the job of the statesman, and this is the job of the world's publics to support this movement toward the dismantling of power so that we can live in a world of peace.
Do you see anything that would encourage you to believe that we can, in fact, dismantle this power?
If you say can, yes. If you say will, no. Mm-hmm. Because can means is it possible, and it certainly is possible, and as the gifts of communication enlarge and bring the world closer together, we can get a consensus, a human consensus, behind the dismantling of power. And this is, it seems to me, the central task of communications for the next 25 years.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's take the will part of that question.
The will part of the question is, at the present time, we still aren't able to face up to it because it looks like too much of a job. No one trusts the Soviet Union, and behind the Soviet Union is Communist China, and nobody trusts Communist China. And we have to take a step at a time. The first step was the nuclear test ban treaty. That step hasn't been followed by another step yet. And there have to be steps like this, one after another. Both the United States and the Soviet Union have committed themselves to a policy of complete disarmament of national armies and the establishment of a force under a world organization to maintain the peace. That was done in a resolution of September 20th, 1961, which the General Assembly adopted.
Now this would be a national police force of sorts.
Yes, and this was American policy then and Soviet policy then. It still is our policy, although I doubt whether 2% of the American people are aware of it.
Mm-hmm. Where in this context, then, would you place General de Gaulle's recent movements?
General de Gaulle is enjoying the liberty of action which he got through the Marshall Plan.
Please elaborate.
Well, I mean by that that having made Europe strong again, we had to expect Europe to be more independent, and General de Gaulle is now being more independent. He isn't being pro-communist. He's just as much anti-communist as we are, but he's trying to get a good place for France in this new world, and he is trying to shake off a little the burdens of American leadership. But I don't think that we need to take General de Gaulle quite as seriously as we are doing.
I think perhaps we are, but I wonder if there might not be some truth to this, that he is, after all, allowed a certain amount of latitude because he does not bear the same degree of responsibility for world peace that the United States and the Soviet Union do.
That's right. I agree with you completely.
If
he had the job of maintaining the peace which we have, he wouldn't be behaving the way he's behaving.
So it does annoy us from time to
time. It annoys us. Naturally, it annoys us because we're human, and he is a very obstinate and disagreeable man in some respects.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've mentioned, I think, probably what you consider the greatest foreign story of this day. What do you think is the greatest domestic story?
Oh, certainly civil liberties, because we have now an obligation to fulfill the promises of the Constitution to 10% of the population of the United States. Mm-hmm. And we've been putting it off year after year, decade after decade, and now the time has come when this promise needs to be fulfilled.
Why do you think the time has come now? Why this particular time?
Well, it's come now because the breath of liberty is being breathed all over the world. There's been the explosion of independence in Africa, in Southeast Asia, and we can't very well be the leaders of that if we have not given real equality to the members of the American family.
It was just about 25 years ago next week that you told this Easter story on NBC Radio. Let's listen.
Now, I want to change the subject to something that is a long way from wars and the rumors of wars, and tell what happens to be an Easter story, a belated one, and happens, too, to have a social meaning in the United States. It's about a singer. She is a woman named Marian Anderson. She's a great artist, and her voice is of a beauty, to quote Toscanini, that comes only once in 100 years. Miss Anderson is a member of the Negro race. When she sings in Carnegie Hall in New York City, the house is always sold out because she's a beautiful singer. And her audience doesn't come because she is a Negress or stay away because she is one. But we have in the United States the mythical frontier, the Mason and Dixon line, and south of that line, the Negro is required to accept certain limits upon his constitutional rights of equality. And this southern territory includes the capital of the United States. Negro and white children in Washington do not attend the same schools, nor do their parents go to the same cinemas and theaters, nor can they put up at the same hotels. In Washington, the largest auditorium belongs to the Daughters of the American Revolution, and its name is Constitution Hall. And one might suppose that a hall with that name and with such an ownership would be open to an artist named Marian Anderson for a concert. But when Miss Anderson's manager asked for the hall, he was told it was booked and wouldn't be available. He then went to the Washington Board of Education and asked for a high school auditorium, but was refused that. Since Washington is in the District of Columbia, which is governed by the Congress of the United States, this was, in effect, a refusal by the nation itself to let Marian Anderson sing in one of the nation's school auditoriums. Now, this all happened some weeks ago and has been the cause of a lively controversy. Heifetz, the violinist, was one of the first to make a protest. He said he would refuse to play in Constitution Hall if Miss Anderson couldn't sing there. Then Mrs. Roosevelt, the First Lady of the land, resigned as member of the Daughters of the American Revolution as a protest against their discrimination. The Washington School Board reversed its position and was prepared to let Miss Anderson sing in a high school auditorium. And then Secretary Ickes, the embattled protagonist of civil liberties and Secretary of the Interior, offered to Miss Anderson the privilege of giving a recital yesterday, Easter, from the portico of the Lincoln Memorial, which is the first time that memorial has ever been used for such a purpose. Singing at the memorial to Abraham Lincoln is equally appropriate for Miss Anderson as singing in an auditorium called Constitution Hall. Now, this is the flaring up of an old controversy in the United States and has more to it than the question whether a great artist should be banned from an auditorium because of her race. It's a symbol of the whole problem of the treatment of Negroes in the United States. Miss Anderson, no doubt, has gained through the nationwide discussion of the indignity to which she has been subjected. The discussion marks another stage in the struggle of the Negro for equal opportunity. And with Miss Anderson, her whole race will have been helped. But the position of the Negro in the United States is still far behind what it needs to be if this country wants to feel it is living up to its own principles.
Beautifully said, Raymond Swain. There is, of course, a 1964 sequel to that Easter story of 25 years ago, but before we talk about it, our NBC network stations must have 65 seconds to transact business on Monitor, which is nationwide. In the area around Wausau, Wisconsin, people hear us on WSAU. There and everywhere, you're on the Monitor Beacon. Now, resuming our conversation with Raymond Swing, the radio commentator who made the two words good evening bywords around the world. Before the interruption, we were listening to a moving playback of a Swing report on Marian Anderson and her concert at the Lincoln Memorial 25 years ago. Mr. Swing, what would you say is the sequel to that civil rights story?
Well, the sequel has been the remarkable improvement in the thinking of this country as to, in regard to the Negro. We've had the Supreme Court decision over school integration, and we've had the whole country marshaled in the opening of schools in the South to Negroes, and we've had a campaign under Martin Luther King of protest on the basis of nonviolence, which to my mind, as a person who's been in India, has been a remarkable experience to see, because this was the doctrine of Gandhi. Mm-hmm. Under the practice of this, Gandhi got India free from England, and the greatest force there is in the world today is not the force of the hydrogen bomb, really. It's the force of human beings who refuse to cooperate in a nonviolent way. Mm-hmm. And the Negroes have adopted this all over the country. I hope they can keep on having the movement nonviolent. Mm-hmm. Because it came then to its head in the great march on Washington, or the march in Washington of last August, which was one of the most remarkable demonstrations I think I've ever witnessed, and one of the most moving.
And at which Marian Anderson again sang in front of the Lincoln Memorial.
Yes.
We can look back 25 years and see that the Negro in America has made progress, and I think we're entitled to some measure of satisfaction in that. But I wonder if, taking just that view, we might not become a little too complacent.
Oh, I don't want to be complacent, because I think we've got to go a lot further. But I think we must see it in perspective, that progress has been made since this last broadcast that you heard.
Yes, it certainly has. Now, you addressed a college assembly back in 1941, a college that at that time had a strong communist cell, and the words you used to deflate their theories, I think, were indelible. You said at that time, "You can always out-argue the apologist if you can rest your case on a blueprint, for there are no imperfections in a blueprint. And there are imperfections in the United States. But what is notable about this country of ours is not its completeness, but that the opportunity remains to complete it." Now, that brings me to a two-part question. First, how great do you think is the communist threat internally in the United States today? And secondly, what would you say to a pro-communist student group today, should you address one?
Well, I don't think that there's much organized communism in America today. I think at the time that I addressed that, the young people felt that they were dissatisfied with their own country and its imperfections, and that this blueprint was going to lead right off to heaven, and they were going along with it. But today, I think they're a lot wiser, and I don't think that there's hardly any communism among young people today.
Mm-hmm. So you don't think you'd have occasion to address a pro-communist student group today, but the analysis that you gave at that time would still hold?
Oh, it certainly would, and it's a whole lot easier to be, as a youngster, to believe in a blueprint than it is to understand that democracy is two things. It's freedom, but it's also the freedom to make your own changes as they are called for, mm-hmm. which you don't have under a communist state of society. You don't have that freedom. The changes have to be made above and imposed upon you.
You said in the beginning your answer to that series of questions that you didn't think there was much organized communism in the United States today. Well, as you well know, the John Birch Society would vehemently disagree with you. I wonder, how seriously do you regard them as a threat to American democracy?
Numerically, they're a very small body. But when you see such a thing as the McCarthy exploitation of the radical right and the power that he was able to get by exploiting it, you realize that the danger is that they're always there to be exploited by a demagogue like McCarthy. And then you have to go through the very painful process of getting the thing down to size again.
Mm-hmm. Let me, if I might, Mr. Swing, lead you back through the years here for a little while. It'd be an enjoyable exercise for us. I hope it might be for you. You knew a good many men in high places, and I would appreciate your making recollections about them for us. What manner of man did you find Franklin D. Roosevelt to be?
You mean personally?
Yes.
In personal contact. I had very little personal contact with him. I attended these press conferences around his desk in the White House when he was rather supercilious and ironical and making fun with the correspondents. But I only had one long personal talk with him one evening when Harry Hopkins was with him and called me up and said, "We've just been listening to your commentary. Would you like to come over and meet the president?" And I said, "Well, I'll be there." And and I had a remarkable experience. He talked with great frankness from one subject to another. One of the things that he talked about, particularly that night, was how he had been trying to persuade Winston Churchill that the thing to do about India was to set it free.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But he went on talking and talking and talking so that I realized this man was almost a compulsive conversationalist. And it was very agreeable to be there and listening to it.
Was he quite animated in his speech?
Oh, yes. He was very lively and very candid, and he kept roaming from one subject to another, drinking a gin and tonic as he went along.
It was his favorite drink, I think,
yes,
was it not?
Yes.
What about Winston Churchill?
Well, I had three or four interesting talks with Winston Churchill. He was, of course, a man of tremendous force in what he said and in his power of expression, and a man that it was a great privilege to talk to, because he happened to have known my work. I did the American commentary for the British Broadcasting Company during the years when the British were waiting for us to come into the war.
Mm-hmm.
And he liked those commentaries very much, and so he was inclined to be very cordial to me, very kind to me.
Do you recall anything specifically that you discussed in any conversation with him?
Well, I had one curious conversation with him, which I've told about in my book. I went to England just after the Blitz were ended, and was invited to Chequers, which is the country house of the Prime Minister, to a dinner and to a luncheon, and sat next to the Prime Minister. And afterwards, he took me out into the garden and talked to me for about 20 minutes about what good peace terms Britain might make with Hitler.
What peace terms they might make with Hitler?
Yes, very generous peace terms. And he walked up and down, and I thought, my goodness, why is he saying these things to me? Does he think that if America thinks he might make a good peace with Hitler, that we're more likely or less likely to come into the war? Mm-hmm. And Hess, mm-hmm. the German Hess had landed in England. Just
Rudolf, just
a couple of weeks before that. Mm-hmm. And I assumed that these peace terms had been given to Churchill by Hess, mm-hmm. and he was trying to prod the Americans to, look, if you don't come into this war, we might sell out. Well, I didn't like this conversation. Mm-hmm. Then, quite a while afterwards, several years afterwards, I had a chance down in Strasbourg, where Churchill had come to address the European Assembly. I had a chance to see him again, and I reminded him of this conversation, and I asked him whether these peace terms had come from Hess. He said no. They were just his assumptions. As a matter of fact, as history has now proven, they're the terms that Hitler himself offered before England came into the war.
I see. Mm-hmm.
But he was trying to influence me, to influence the Americans. As a matter of fact, I'd never told anybody about the conversation.
See, his ploy didn't work.
No.
Well, let's turn to a woman. Mrs. Eleanor Roosevelt.
I didn't meet Mrs. Eleanor Roosevelt until after the war, and I went several times for the Voice of America to European conferences, and I crossed on the boat with her, and she was in the American delegation, and I had many opportunities to talk with her, and it was a treat, because here was a woman who is lucid, and who is morally completely right, in, as I see complete rightness, morality, in the international and world affairs. Her battle for the human rights in the United Nations is one of the great achievements of ever made by any woman at any time.
How do you compare coverage of the news today with the reporting of your day?
I think that the improvement in communications is one of the terrific changes that's taken place. We're living in all kinds of new ages, you know. Now we're living in the nuclear age, and we're living in the space age. We're living in the electronic age. We're living in the age where distance is being annihilated, and we're creating a world neighborhood in which we ultimately, as I say, are going to have to live in peace with one another or be destroyed.
I have thought sometimes that one result of an improvement in communications, at least the initial result, let me see if I can get this right, is to further compound the confusion. The initial result is this, because the thing that you thought you understood about another person or another country turns out not to be precisely true. They don't react exactly the same way that you thought they might have, so that just the increase in communication initially seems to further confuse it.
Well, I think that as the world grows closer together and becomes more into a neighborhood, it's going to become more discordant.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that's a thing to be dismayed about, because we have all the discordancy that you can want in our domestic life, don't we? And this will simply be amplified into world relations. What we have to learn is that our discordance doesn't lead to violence.
Say it again.
I say what we have to learn is that our discordance doesn't lead to violence.
Thank you, Mr. Swing. It's been a rich half hour. We have been talking with Raymond Swing, 77 years old on March 25th, but still very much a man whose voice goes into the microphone, sounding, as they once said, like a lion, because that's the way he feels, but comes out sounding like a lamb. Raymond Swing, radio commentator of the old school, who's written a professional memoir whose title was his byword. So, Mr. Swing, would you say it?
Good evening.
Now a word for the National Automobile Dealers Association, which, like all worthwhile organizations, has a purpose. Since NADA is made of local new car dealers throughout the country,
It's not surprising that one of its main purposes is driver safety. It takes three things, all of them beginning with the letter C to be a safe driver. Courtesy, care, and common sense.
This is Frank McGee, your host on Monitor 64.
Monitor, your news and information center on the NBC Radio Network.